Welcome to another episode of Sharing the Hope from the Mike and Mason Foundation. I'm your host, Patrick Mason, and today I am joined by Diane Pickles. How are you doing today, Diane?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking, Patrick.
Good deal. So, Diane is our first returner, our first second time we get to do a check-in and another podcast and to find out more of what's been going on. So we'll get right into it. So Diane, I understand you are working with a group called Additional Ventures, and you've been with them for a little while. Can you tell us about Additional Ventures, what their mission is and the work they're trying to do?
Sure, I would be happy to do that. So yes, I've been with Additional Ventures for just over 4 years. And Additional Ventures is a nonprofit foundation whose mission is to cure single ventricle heart disease through transformative research and strategic investments that revolutionize treatment and care. So that's our mission statement. And we really work hand in hand with the research community to really bring more researchers into the single ventricle space, providing various types of support, including funding, in order to improve treatments and then find cures for single ventricle patients. We've been in existence for about 5 years, and in that time, we've funded more than $95 million in single ventricle research. That has gone out to about 150 investigators, some of whom have done multiple projects. It's not 150 research projects, but 150 unique investigators. And then a lot of co-PIs and junior investigators that work underneath and with them. So many, many more people than 150, but 150 unique principal investigators. The work so far has actually already shown some really promising outcomes, including we've seen more than 120 publications as a result of the research, and about 20 biomarkers and therapeutic targets have been identified, and those could really be used to improve treatments for patients. So we have several different types of grant programs, all of which are focused on single ventricle heart disease, and all of our research investments are guided by our research roadmap, which provides a framework for how we can achieve curative solutions for single ventricle. And the program that I direct, called Single Ventricle Source, we call it SOURCE for short, is one of what we call our foundational resources. And these are investments we make in developing open access data sets to drive research in the single ventricle space.
Okay, good deal. So for folks who have never had to submit a grant to the National Science Foundation or for any of the other organizations' grants, so let's break some terms down. What is a principal investigator?
Principal investigator is basically like the lead investigator or the lead researcher on a project. So yeah, so when I say we've funded 150 principal investigators, that would be lead researchers on a project. And as I said, it has been many more than 150 projects that we've actually funded across our research projects, but 150 of those have been those lead researchers. And many come back and do follow-up projects and follow-up research initiatives, which is really exciting as well. And we've really seen one of the most amazing and I think impactful things that Additional Ventures has done is really grow the research community. We host a single ventricle investigators meeting every other year, and to see the attendance grow and the enthusiasm in the room grow with each of those meetings, to see really the growth in the number of researchers who are involved in this rare disease research space in just a short amount of time has been really incredible and really inspiring.
That's really awesome. So these researchers, are we talking primarily scientists working at a lab? Are we talking about doctors at a hospital? Where are these folks?
A mix of that and a range of different types of researchers. So some are researchers who are full-time in a lab. Some of them are what I would call clinical researchers. So they are clinicians who are seeing patients, cardiologists seeing patients, and they are also doing research in the lab. There are folks who are doing research in basic biology, tissue engineering, genomics, genetics. So a real range of disciplines as well that we see people engaged in.
So your primary involvement is with the SOURCE, which you call the Single Ventricle SOURCE Study, or just SOURCE for short. What is sort of the goal or aim of that study?
Yeah. So SOURCE is a research study. As I said, we call it one of our foundational projects. It's a research study whose goal is to discover the causes of single ventricle heart disease as well as the many related complications and comorbidities that go along with single ventricle. And the reason we want to understand what causes single ventricle is that that will help us get to better treatments and even potentially cures for these diseases. And so in our study, we're aiming to achieve that goal by building the world's largest genetics data set of single ventricle patients and their immediate family members, and then making the de-identified data available free of charge to researchers to fuel as much research as we can as quickly as possible. And our goal is to recruit at least 5,000 patients and at least 5,000 immediate family members as well. And we're recruiting patients at any age or stage, all single ventricle diagnoses, including post-transplant, and then their biological immediate family members. So that includes their parents, their siblings, and then any children of adult single ventricle patients as well, all to join the study. And so obviously anyone who's listening that meets those criteria, I hope would check us out at svsource.org and learn more and think about joining, but I'm happy to share lots more details. And one other thing I thought I would mention, Patrick, is that the last time you said I'm the first returner, which gives me that's a great point of pride. It's like coming back. But returner on Saturday Night Live or something, I feel like very, very proud, right? Last time you and I spoke on your podcast, the study had a different name. So before we had launched, we had a different name for our study. And we decided before we went live with the study to change the name to actually get closer to our goal and our aim, which is to uncover the source of single ventricle. So hence the name change. So we launched in December and we're now actively enrolling participants to join the study.
Okay. So there is a desire for both the patients themselves and family members. Why do we want family members? What's the purpose?
Yeah, great question. And it's so important that people really understand why it is important so that people will want to join, whether they're a patient or a family member. So, you know, in order to really learn about the disease, it's really important that we can recruit large numbers of patients as well as their biological family members. And that is because, in a nutshell, studying family, what we call family cohorts, right? The whole family, both those who are affected than those who are unaffected. Basically, we can learn more and we can learn it faster. So if we study families, we can learn about the genetic mutations, sometimes called variants, that happen in a disease, right? So somebody who has single ventricle and we study their genetics, we can see that there are things in their genes that are variants, that are genetic mutations that shouldn't be there, right? That are different. When we study the whole family, we're able to look and identify which of those variants are inherited or passed down from the parents and which of them are de novo, or that means those are new mutations that are not inherited. And that's really helpful for researchers to learn more about those specific genetic mutations. Most of the time, family members are unaffected and we don't see the disease repeat in the biological immediate family members. But we certainly know that we see single ventricle families where we have more than one affected individual. So studying all types of single ventricle families is incredibly helpful to the research. And again, as I said, it helps us learn more and learn it faster.
Okay, so what about our current state of knowledge about the cause or causes? Potentially.
Yeah.
Where are we with that? And why do we think genetics is the way to go on this one?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's one that I'm really glad you asked, because it's something that is there's so much misunderstanding, I think, currently. There's actually a really great article and a video that's on the Source website. It's on the resources page from a wonderful clinician named Dr. Jane Neuberger. So if you'd like more information, I think that's just a great resource, because I'm a lay person explaining this. But here's what we do know in my layman's terms. What we do know is that there's more than one cause for single ventricle. And certainly we know there's many different types of single ventricle heart disease, right? So different causes likely for the different types of diseases. We certainly know that genetics plays a role. We know that there is more than one gene involved. There have been a handful of genes that have been identified as being associated with single ventricle, but none of them have been identified as being the cause of single ventricle. We also know that there are non-genetic causes or factors like environment that contribute as well. So we believe that genetics plays a role. we believe it's more than one gene. We believe environment contributes as well. And we also believe that genetics likely plays a role in some of the complications and comorbidities. So for example, some single ventricle patients might be more likely to develop arrhythmia or PLE because of their genetics. So right now we have a lot of questions, not a lot of answers, but we do have enough research that has shown that genetics definitely plays a role and probably a strong role, but we really need to unpack it. And it's really problematic that we don't understand it because it limits our ability to develop better treatments for patients. So that's what makes the study that we're doing so important.
Okay. And just to give people a feel for it, we, at least I think in the US, we get about 1,000 new patients a year, if I've done my math correctly. So 5,000 people is, for this data set, that's a large number of people. You're talking 5 years worth of patients. Is there a desire for this to stay like an internal within the United States, or are you looking to get participants from international communities because that could help you eliminate or highlight the maybe non-genetic, but the environmental factors?
Yeah, it's a great question and an interesting suggestion to think about it that way with the environment. For now, we are focused on the United States for recruitment of participants, and that's largely just due to the complications of trying to recruit from outside the United States and some of the different regulatory factors that go into other countries have different regulations. However, that doesn't mean we won't do that. And certainly there might be ways that we could partner with other institutions, particularly those that maybe already have existing biospecimens or existing data sets. And we might be able to work together to bring that data together into the source data set. And we're in some conversations with institutions in other countries to think about how we might do that. But for now, our active recruitment in source is focused on the United States. However, the research and the access to the data set will be worldwide. We certainly want to encourage researchers anywhere in the world to utilize the data set.
And that hits on a pretty important topic these days. So HIPAA is pretty strong in the US in protecting people's right to privacy for their medical records. Although one of the interesting things that's going on right now with the, I think with the sale of 23andMe, we saw basically genetic data being a commodity, getting effectively sold to, you know, whoever bought them out. And so that is a big question, I think, in a lot of people's minds who have been involved in these sort of, yeah, I won't call them genetic studies because they were kind of ad hoc genetic fun things. But since you guys are not specifically like a hospital or government lab or anything, what kind of protection and controls do you have for this data? Since this is, you know, we're talking about DNA. So this is sort of like, this is you, right? And so what's the kind of protections you get?
Yeah. I mean, privacy of participants is incredibly important. We are asking every participant who joins the study to donate a DNA sample. And we're asking patients to share their cardiac medical records. That is not a small ask. And so we're very aware of that. And so privacy is of paramount importance to us. And so we are taking lots of steps to put safeguards in place. So the biggest thing we are doing is that we are making sure that researchers will only have access to what we call de-identified data. So what that means is that we will remove all identifiers. So things like your name, your address will never be associated with your genetic data or any of the clinical data that is moved into the data set. So basically, all of the researchers will only have access to this de-identified data. When you enroll in source, you are given a randomized participant ID number, and all of the identifying information is removed from your data. So the researchers will never have access to that identifiable information. I would say also that, you know, we've got a study protocol that has been carefully developed, and that document has been reviewed and approved by an institutional review board, also known as an IRB. And that's a committee that reviews research that involves human subjects to make sure that it is conducted safely and ethically for patients. That's a big difference between us and a 23andMe or another, you know, as you said, one of these commercial entities that might be for fun or other purposes. This is a study. It is a scientific, it's a human subject study. And so we are IRB reviewed and approved. And that means that we follow to the letter our protocol. And so I think that all of those things, we really have patient privacy, participant privacy at the forefront. of what we're doing.
Okay, good. It's all very good to hear. It's good it's considered. Since this is, you know, we're moving into kind of the, as much as I hate to quote a Matthew McConaughey commercial, we're moving into the Wild West of data security. There's a lot out there, people trying to get data and use it nefariously. So it's important that.
Yep. People have significant concerns and rightly so. Yes. Yes.
I know there are other genomic studies out there. In fact, I believe we participated in one with the Mayo Clinic years ago. So what makes this different? What's the sort of scope difference? What's the difference?
You're absolutely correct. We're definitely not the first to attempt to build a genetics data set of single ventricle patients and families. There are literally thousands of patients and families like yourself who have generously donated their DNA to previous studies. And lots of researchers have spent lots of time analyzing those data sets. Yet we still have very little information currently about the causes of single ventricle. So we have all this data, yet we've got very few answers. We have this kind of gap that we haven't been able to bridge. And there's many reasons for that. I think the complexity of the disease makes it really challenging to study. Single ventricle is, as you said earlier, it's very rare. It's also really heterogeneous. There isn't just one type of single ventricle. That makes it very hard to unpack and study. We need a lot of data to make significant discoveries. And the cost of genetic sequencing has definitely been a barrier for researchers and for research. And there's been a lot of operational challenges, I think, as well, that have existed in previous studies. One thing that's really exciting is that we are really planning and hoping to be able to bring in that data from previous studies into SOURCE so that we can really do two things: build power for the study, right, by adding more numbers, and also really value the donation of families like yours who have donated their data to these previous studies to really be able to really maximize that data donation. We don't pretend to have all the answers here, but we've given a lot of thought to the challenges that have existed previously as we've built SOURCE. And we do really believe that SOURCE is designed to bridge this gap between data and answers. And we're confident of that, I think, for three key reasons. First, there are some unique design elements to SOURCE. We've got multiple pathways for enrollment. So this online portal, which I'll talk about at some point, I'm sure, during our conversation, where people can enroll and do everything online. We're also going to do in-clinic recruitment. And then, as I just mentioned, bring data in from previous studies. So we've got multiple pathways for enrollment. We have a very open data access framework without many of kind of the traditional institutional barriers. So, for example, we'll make the data available for free to all researchers who are qualified. And we're not going to limit research to just single ventricle research or even CHD research, because we don't know where the big discoveries will come from. And we're not just going to build the data set, but we're also going to provide support to researchers to ensure that they're able to actually utilize the data set. The second reason that we're confident SOURCE will be successful is that we're in a really unique time. The price of genetic sequencing has already plummeted pretty significantly. We think it will continue to go down. And we've got a much bigger understanding of genetics than we've ever had before. AI enables us, not me, but scientists, researchers, data people, to analyze very large data sets in ways that was previously unimaginable. And finally, the third reason we're really confident that we'll be successful is that we have the benefit of being able to stand on the shoulders of all those who came before us. And so we are really confident that the way SOURCE is built, the time we're in, gives us the ability to really scale and grow to get the data we need to really give researchers what they need to be successful here. And all that we can learn from these previous studies, for all of those reasons, we're really confident that we can finally get to the answers that we need. But we're not the first, you're right. But we hope that this will be the thing that researchers will need to finally unpack and get us the answers that patients desperately need us to get to.
So you said you've been open since December. How has enrollment been going?
It's going really well. It's been really great to see enrollment continue to grow. So yes, we launched in December. As of this morning, we have just shy of 190 people who are enrolled. That's about half patients and half immediate family members, which is really nice. And the numbers are continuing to grow, which is great. And we feel really good about the number in such a short amount of time. But certainly I am being the perfectionist that I am. I always see room for improvement. So we definitely have more minor patients than adult patients. We see more parents enrolling their single ventricle children than we do adults enrolling themselves. So we would love to see those adult patient numbers increase. We're also not seeing a lot of unaffected siblings get enrolled. And as I mentioned earlier, family cohorts are so important. So as parents enroll their single ventricle child, we're really hoping that they'll also enroll the unaffected siblings because that's really important. We're also hoping they'll also enroll themselves as the parent and invite the other parent to join. And I'd love to see everyone who enrolls in Source utilize, there's a function in the portal where you can invite your other eligible family members to join the study. And what's nice about that is it's, you know, it's a prompt to those other people to join, but it also enables us in the platform to link those family members together, which is really great because then researchers know, again, it's all de-identified, but they can say participant 1, 2, 3, 4 is linked to 5, 6, 7, 8, and they can link that family cohort together, which is great. So things are going well, but obviously room for improvement. Oh, and the last thing I would say is about a little over 50% of people have returned, those who have enrolled have returned their DNA kits. So we mail those to people's homes and we can't complete enrollment until we get people's samples back. So I get it. I think my own sample sat on my kitchen counter for about 2 weeks, Patrick, before I mailed it back, which is really embarrassing. You get busy. It's just like, you're like, oh, I'm going to do that. But we really need to get closer to 100% of kit returns. So room for improvement. Things are going really well, but we still have things that we'd like to see improve and get better and ways to grow. Oh, so areas, room for improvement.
Now, I think our sample has been sitting on our dining room table for about a week now. And like, I have it set up this weekend.
Yes. You're like, oh, I'm going to do that. Right. Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I can remember when we did the Mayo Clinic one, it was the same thing. It was like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. My son said, oh, I keep meaning to do it, but I keep forgetting that I can't eat or drink anything for 30 minutes beforehand. And then every time I think to do it, I've had coffee or water or something within 30 minutes. So yeah, anyway, I get it.
So how does one sign up for this? If I'm listening to this and I want to go sign up, how do I do
that? Yeah. As I've mentioned a couple of times, we have this online portal. So an online platform, svsource.org, where people can do everything online. And there's a couple steps in the process. So the first step is that you sign a consent form, as you would in any study. Well, actually, I should say the first step is to read about the study. So if you go to the website, there's all kinds of information, frequently asked questions. I think all the information that you would need to understand what we're doing and why is on there. And if not, people should contact us and ask. So the first step is to sign the consent form. So that would be either, you know, a self-consent form for an adult or a parental consent for a parent. And then we do also ask parents who are enrolling a child who's over the age of 7 to ask that child to provide assent. So it's not legal consent, but we think it's really important that the child is informed about what they're participating in and assents to participate. And so that's an additional form just to sign that the child has provided assent. And then patients sign a medical record release, which says that they're willing to share their cardiac medical records with the study. The second step is a short medical history that, again, is online that we ask patients and family members to complete. And then the third step is we mail out this DNA collection kit. It's a cheek swab, and we mail that to people's homes, and you swab your cheek, and then you mail it back. And then the final step in the process, which just applies to patients, is to share their cardiac medical records. And we provide a couple different options for doing this. The quickest and most efficient way is to work with our team at Boston Children's Hospital. And basically, they can get on a Zoom call and help the patient get into their patient portal and download the exact records that are needed. And it takes 30 minutes or less. And the feedback from the people who have utilized that option is that it was really quick and easy. And it ensured that the BCH team got exactly the records that they needed. The other option is to find the records yourself and upload them to the site, or emailing or faxing them to Boston Children's. And any of those options work. But the feedback we've gotten so far is that working with the Boston Children's team is the quickest and easiest. And then the last thing that we ask people to do, as I said earlier, is to invite eligible family members to join the study as well. And again, they can do that also from the online portal.
Okay. And I think when I signed up, I did it for myself and my son, but it didn't honestly occur to me at the time to sign my daughter up. So you mentioned earlier about getting the siblings, and mm-hmm. I don't know if there was anything in there to prompt me to do that or not. But yeah, that's something I'm definitely going to take a look at.
Yeah, I think you have to go back to the home part of your dashboard and you'll get a pop-up, but it's really good feedback. So again, we're continuing to make improvements in the site based on feedback that we get from participants. So I'm really glad that you said that. We've also heard feedback from a couple of parents who have enrolled their minor child who have said, I thought when I enrolled my minor child, I enrolled myself at the same time, but you actually have to do two different signups. So it's a little bit, I think we still have things we need to improve in the site. Most of the feedback we've gotten from people so far has been that the site is super quick and easy to navigate, but clearly there's still things that are, you know, a little confusing to people. So we still need to make some improvements. We'll get there. Yeah. We'll get there.
Good deal. So as we bring in the data, what's the thought process about when you think research will start actually being able to take place?
Yeah, I'm always hesitant to give like a timeline, right? Because you always throw it out there and then it changes. But I'm hoping that sometime late this year, so sometime late in 2025, we will be able to open up the data set. And basically what we're doing is trying to get in enough patients and family members so that we have a significant amount of data to then open up to researchers. So we won't wait until we hit our goal of 10,000 to open it up, but we'll make sure we have a robust set enough data to open it up. The data set will be available to all researchers that apply and are approved by a data access committee. And that data access committee will basically review it'll be a very simple online application. They'll confirm that the researcher is who they say they are, that they're doing ethical research, nothing nefarious. And as I said previously, they'll only get access to de-identified data. So, you know, no identifiers that could identify the individual will be available. And we won't limit the research, as I said, to single ventricle or even to congenital heart disease. And one of the things we're really actually hoping is that there could be researchers from other fields. Maybe there's researchers with amazing expertise in genetics who have never thought about single ventricle, who look at our data set and uncover something amazing and really important. So we're really hoping to have, while keeping participant privacy at the forefront, have the data set be as open and as accessible as possible for research to really drive as much research as we possibly can as quickly as possible. That's the goal.
I like the goal. It's a good goal. And data, what do you call it? Open access data has been a big thought of mine for a long time. The concept that a lot of the medical data is sort of warehoused within specific institutions. And, you know, that's fine if you've got a disease that is common and you have thousands of patients. But when you have a disease that is rare, you really need the kind of centralized and honestly freely accessible. I think I remember talking about the concept that as a parent, I don't care what researcher or what doctor figures this out. Like, I don't.
That's right.
I care
that's
that
right.
happens. I don't
that's
care.
Right. Absolutely. I don't
care what hospital you work at. I don't care. I'm going to shower you with praise, I'm sure, but I could care less whether it's at Texas Children's or Boston or CHOP or Mayo Clinic. What I care is it happens.
That's right.
And so the more people can work together on this sort of stuff, the better.
That's right. I agree. And I, you know, we can't, as patients, as family members, cannot afford for that not to happen. And one of my personal pet peeves is when I hear an institution, an organization, whatever, talk about our data. Mm-hmm. And it's not their data. It's the patient and family. It's the patient data.
Yeah.
Right. I agree with you. And I understand why things are structured the way they're structured. I get it. But I agree with you. We cannot afford to wait. And patients can't afford for things to be slow. And we can't afford not to work together here. So that is absolutely in line with our goals here and our philosophy.
That's awesome. Okay, I've got a crazy question for you. And this is something that's been brewing in my head for probably about a year and a half now. So like you said before, access to the data to researchers is relatively open and free. And I've always thought to myself, you know, I have time where I'm sitting watching football games on Saturdays, where I don't have a whole lot to do with my brain. I'm an engineer, you know, nuclear engineer. So I dealt with large data sets doing lots of little movements and things. I'm not necessarily a geneticist or even biology. You know, I went into the field I did, so I didn't have to take biology in college. But I do know how to deal with large data sets, especially in randomization stuff, you know, which is mutation, that kind of stuff, and radiation. So would somebody like me, somebody who's very invested in the problem and maybe doesn't have the normal stereotypical background, but who could maybe look at the data and model it and run it through some AI, large language, well, maybe not large language model, maybe it's some more of the machine models, just to see what they could come up with. Is that something that's seen as like both possible and or worthwhile by the community, I guess?
I think so, yeah. One of the things that we have talked a lot about is we don't want to, and I think I alluded to this earlier, we don't want to just build this data set. We want to make sure it's not like build it and they will come, right? We've got to work to promote awareness of the data set and also make sure we drive utilization of it. We've talked about data hackathons, really bringing people together, convening groups of people. Sometimes they're done in a nice competitive way where you get teams or groups of people to work together. And I think what you're describing, you'd love something like that, I have a feeling, right? To be part of something like that. Yeah. And I think that, again, as I said earlier, we are not thinking that it's just single ventricle researchers who are going to probably unlock big discoveries here. We need people to come from different backgrounds to figure this problem out. And I think if it were easy to solve and answer these questions, we would have done it already. And so I think we're going to need some different sets of eyes on this. And so, yeah, I mean, we're going to do data hackathons. We're also going to be doing some development of training materials and offering webinars so that people can understand how to utilize the data, because we understand like not everybody's a geneticist. So we want to make sure that the platform is accessible to people so that they can understand how to utilize it. We're not envisioning that it'll just be a genetics expert that'll be analyzing the data. You know, we certainly don't want somebody who's just hacking around looking at the data, right? Again, it'll be a data access committee reviewing proposals. But yes, if it's a person with a valid research intent that's ethical, yeah, I think that we definitely want to bring those people in for sure.
Cool. I like it.
We'll get a hat on, Patrick. I see it.
Mm-hmm. All about it. I think we've covered quite a bit of it. Is there anything we've missed?
I think the only thing I would just say is for people who are interested in learning more, I've mentioned the website. It's svsource.org. We are certainly on social media. So we've got a Facebook account, which is Single Ventricle Source. And we've got an Instagram, I don't know, handle, whatever one would call Instagram, which I think is svsource. If people have any questions, I would love for them to reach out to us. Our email is contact@svsource.org. And I, you know, would be open to any and all questions that people have to answer. We're happy to get on the phone with people and chat more and answer any questions. The response so far from patients and families has been incredibly positive. It's been clear to me that people seem to really understand why this study is so important and are excited about the promise of the study, the hope that it could provide better treatments and ultimately even potentially a cure for single ventricle. And I hope that people feel they can ask any questions to feel comfortable and confident about participating. So yeah, open to just chatting more with people. So thank you for the opportunity to share information about Source.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for returning to the show. I appreciate
you
getting the word out.
My pleasure. Thank you, Patrick.
You're very welcome. Well, I have a feeling we'll be checking in again maybe in a couple of years.
I would love that.
I'm definitely going to be keeping my eye on and hopefully coming out for a hackathon sometime
soon. You got it. Sounds great. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Diane.
Thank you.